from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, we tend to think of religious conversion as a spiritual experience, but historically people have changed religions for many reasons other than faith. Jews in 14th century Spain became Catholics in order to avoid torture and execution, and 19th century German Catholics converted to Protestantism to enter advanced professions. In Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion, author Susan Jacoby takes a closer look at the multitude of factors that have drawn people, from Augustine of Hippo to Muhammad Ali, into religious conversions. We'll also talk to her about a New York Times op-ed on how political campaigns continue to ignore non-religious voters, even though they're growing in number. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Susan Jacoby joins us in studio for the second Forum hour. She's the author of 11 previous books, and she recently published Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion, which takes us from antiquity and St. Paul and St. Augustine through the Inquisition, religious liberty, and the rise of secularism in the United States. Her articles have appeared frequently in the New York Times in the op-ed section, and she joins us, and we welcome her back to the Forum program. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back here.
Well, it's also wonderful to read a book that is so prodigiously researched and so thorough and remarkable in its scope and canvas. I've got to tell you, though, one of the most, I mean, there's a lot of fascinating history here, and we'll get into this, but your own personal history is pretty fascinating. I mean, you've brought it in here. Conversion, you didn't even know your father was Jewish.
No. Well, I believe even when you're doing a scholarly work, if there are things people always ask you, what got you interested in this subject? And certainly one of the things are that I come from a family that's just steeped in religious conversion on two sides. I didn't know my father was Jewish. When he married my Irish Catholic mother, he didn't convert till I was seven. I drilled him on his catechism. God always was, always is, and always remains the same. But we were told he had converted to Catholicism from Episcopalianism. Concealing his Jewish origins was a very big part of my father's motivation for a variety of reasons. He grew up in an environment in which he went to public school, and he was a very small kid. He was beaten up. We're talking about an America of the 1920s, not America today, in relation to attitudes about Jews. And he was called all of the epithets for Jew that you can think of. He was ashamed of being a Jew. And when I asked my dad years later, after I figured out when I was in my teens that Jacoby is almost always a Jewish name, and if you go back far enough, it's always a Jewish name. And he said something very touching. He said, I said, Dad, why didn't you tell us? This is the late 1960s. It was beginning to be fashionable to be Jewish then. My dad said, I didn't want you and your brother to think that if you ever didn't get anything you wanted in life, it was because you were Jewish. I mean, isn't that sad?
It is sad. It's also, in some ways, almost a kind of standard. I couldn't help thinking, I mean, you have all these different reasons for conversion, and one of them, you think of, I was thinking about Heinrich Heine of all, I mean, you do write about him as well, the famous German major figure in literature, who said it was a passport to civilization. The irony being they didn't even let him in the Prussian bar despite the fact that he went through a conversion. So it's often the notion of acceptance. It's often the notion of avoiding the shame or, of course, the indignations that one has to put up with if one is a minority.
Yes. Yes. For Jews, and not just for Jews, but for other people who have found themselves in a minority historically, even to call it social advantage is a little bit too harsh. Because there is a kind of conversion which, while it is not forced, is spurred by the fact that members of minority religions historically have incurred discrimination. Look, my dad grew up at a time when he became a young man that there were Jewish quotas in universities until well into the 1960s. And these were things that, of course, I didn't understand until I started studying the history in general, that attitudes toward Jews, for instance, were not the same in the United States in the 1930s as they were when I was growing up in the 1960s. And so that's something that recurs in different countries in different ways. But what never happened here was you weren't forced to convert here. There wasn't any legal sanction if you did, if your family could get mad at you, and they often did, whatever you did. On my mom's side of the family, also there were conversions. My grandmother, who was a Lutheran German immigrant child, converted to Catholicism in 1918 when she married my grandfather, just to please his mother. And it almost didn't happen. It was clearly not a spiritual conversion. She did it. Mixed marriage has been one of the major drivers of conversions throughout Western history. When they went to the priest to take instruction in the faith, the priest asked outright whether my grandmother was in the family way. He wasn't eager to have my grandfather marry out of the church, even though she was converting. And my grandfather said, she's as pure as the Virgin Mary, no thanks to me. And he dragged her out of there and he said, we're going to City Hall to get married. And she said, no, no, we'll find another priest. I want to please your mother. This is a typical American story, not as typical then, you know, as it would become later, but this has always been a part of American history.
Well, in fact, when you talk about conversions, particularly in contemporary times, you kind of intimate that a lot of them have to do with pleasing the partner that one is marrying. And I get the sense from your writing that many of those conversions, at least from your perspective and probably from the perspective of some of those people who go through those conversions, is not necessarily really anchored in a deep belief or faith.
No,
it can be, but more cases than not, it's not.
Right, of course, it can. It can be. There are people who genuinely, through exposure to the faith of someone they love, come to believe in that faith. But also, it's very often just a feeling. A lot of these are people like my grandmother Broderick, who believed in God. As far as she was concerned, it was all the same God. And, you know, whether there was a Son and a Holy Ghost, the things that people in Europe killed each other over for hundreds of years didn't much matter to her. She believed in God, and she didn't much care whether she went to a Lutheran or a Catholic church. And there are a lot of people who feel that way. Just one religion is as good as another.
Well, let's talk about some of the people you profile here. I mean, we go back, I said, to a couple of saints, St. Augustine and St. Paul. I didn't realize St. Augustine was such an anti-Semite. Burning in Carthage and all the rest of that, but he had a pretty serious sex addiction, and you feel that that may have been the reason, in fact, for his conversion.
Not at all. I don't think Augustine was a sex addict. I think he had an attitude about sex that it was sinful, that he was at war. In other words, Christianity, conversion to Christianity in the early centuries of the church, not only was chastity not required as a condition of conversion to Christianity, it wasn't required. Priests could be married then too. So I don't think that Augustine had a sex addiction in the modern sense at all. What he was obsessed with, though, was original sin. He was obsessed with the idea of sex as sinful. Not, I think, because his sex life was all that unusual. As far as history knows, he had one mistress and one son before he converted and took his private vows of chastity. How is that sex addiction?
Well, I'm thinking of maybe addiction is wrong, an obsession. He and St. Paul both had obsession with sex.
Well, yes, and also with sex as one of the most serious forms of sin. And for example, I think Augustine would have been much better to be obsessed with the deadly sin of pride, which he had, you know, in ample measure. He wasn't as anti-Semitic as some of his contemporaries like John Chrysostom. Augustine started the formula. He said, we should harass Jews but not destroy them, because his belief was that Jews should be present in the world as an example of what there was before Christianity and as an example to why you should convert to Christianity. The harass but do not destroy formula sounds mean now. He was actually, quote, more progressive, and I put the word quotes around the word progressive, than some of his contemporaries who believed right from the start that, Jews should be exterminated. But mostly, if you read Confessions and others of Augustine's patristic writings, mostly he was obsessed with original sin, which is why he became the favorite church father of Calvin as well as the Roman Catholic Church.
What about St. Paul, though? I mean, the whole trip to Damascus and all the rest of it, bop on the head, you call it. I mean, it's right on the cover of your book and so forth. That's a conversion that in some ways seems to be almost widely metaphorical to you of kind
well,
of conversion.
Well, first of all, we only know about this from the Acts of the Apostles. He doesn't talk much about his conversion in his actual epistle except that he was given grace. We do know that he was a persecutor of Jews in Jerusalem who were interested in what was called the Way then. We know
He was Saul of Tarsus originally, though.
Yes, he was Saul of Tarsus originally. He just became called Paul in Christian history. We know he was on his way to Damascus to find out if there were other Jews in Damascus who were interested in starting groups of the Way and bring them back to the high priest in Jerusalem for judgment. That we know, as I say, to the extent that the Acts of the Apostles is a historical document, which it is, of course, like the rest of the Bible, only in part. So that we don't know exactly what made Paul change from a persecutor, Saul change from a persecutor of Jews into Paul of Tarsus. Now, Gary Wills, in a particularly ridiculous aspect of his, I should say, very negative review of my book in the New York Times, said I chose the cover, which is Caravaggio's Saul on the Road to Damascus, which shows him hitting his head at a very large horse. He said I had clearly picked this picture for my cover because I needed it to be a very tall horse, because my whole point is that somebody has to have their brains be addled to convert. Well, I'll tell you, on this program, I picked the cover because I saw this great, great painting decades ago in the Church of Santa Maria del Popolo in the Piazza del Popolo, and I remembered it. And since Saul Paul is the iconic conversion, I thought it was a very beautiful, beautiful painting.
I read the Wills review.
The thing about the cover, though, was the most hilarious part of the review. That one would actually pick a cover with a really big horse on it. I guess Caravaggio made the horse big for the same reason. I do believe he was a Christian.
I also, with all due respect for Gary Wills, who is someone, you know, I've looked admiringly toward as a scholar, as a fellow scholar for many, many years, he talks about your conversion to atheism at age 14 and sort of suggested from that point on you were a know-it-all. I think that's pretty much paraphrasing what he said.
Yes, yes. It's true. After working on a book for 6 years and realizing how much you still don't know, it's amazing. But I don't – by the way, I do talk about atheism. I don't regard people who become atheists or secular humanists or however they define themselves. I don't consider most of those conversions because it's more a slow process. It isn't like a light blinding in your head. It's mostly thinking, certainly in my case, having been raised a Catholic and what I was being taught in Catholic school not making sense to me. And one of the things that first happens when you start this process is you look around at other religions. And eventually I decided that they all had Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, God becoming man, all of these things. I gradually grew to realize I didn't believe in them. The only time I consider a conversion from a religion to atheism, a true conversion, is if it's linked up with a secular ideology that has all of the imperviousness to evidence of the most retrograde forms of traditional religion. In other words, I'm thinking of the attraction of Western intellectuals to Stalinism in the 1920s and 30s. Well, Stalinist communism was a religion, not because atheism, communists were mostly atheists, but because it was as impervious to the evidence that its economic system and it didn't work as any traditional religion was to the fact that people actually don't rise from the dead.
Well, we're talking to Susan Jacoby. Her new book is Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. And as I said, and as you've just mentioned, there's a lot about secularism, particularly about the United States. But let's sort of focus for a little while on American history, because you get into it. You get into, for example, the fact that Paul Revere and George Washington were both of a kind of descent of Huguenots, which allowed for them to be maybe more open-minded, and America was a place of refuge. Puritans came here for religious freedom. Very anomalous, unusual in that sense, and continues to be. And then you have other religions, of course, that have changed. Mormons and Christian Scientists have changed the whole sort of religious landscape of America. But forced conversions, which you write about, in Spain with Jews, with Catholics, and being forced into Protestantism and so forth. Slaves. I mean, this is certainly something that we always have to take into account when we look at American history. They were, for the most part, forced into the religion of Christianity.
Well, slavery isn't it always the rock on which America stumps its toe, to paraphrase Langston Hughes. It's always forgotten. There was a lot of controversy in the 17th century among Southern planters about whether slaves who were about 80% of them were various forms of paganism and polytheism from African traditions, and about 20% were Muslims, which is something that's generally forgotten. And there was all this controversy about whether they should be taught about Christianity, because even though it was attractive on the one hand for planters to have slaves who were the same religion that they were, there was also, although there are things in the Bible that justify slavery, that are against slavery, the story of Exodus, there are also things in the Bible that support slavery, namely Saul into Paul, servants be subject to your masters. There was a guy named Thomas Bacon, an Anglican minister, who wrote sermons in London in the 1700s, specifically designed for masters to read to slaves on the plantations, which explained to them that even though they were becoming Christians, that didn't mean that they were in any way the equal of their masters or released from their obligation to servitude. And of course, these sermons quoted Paul, servants be subject to your masters.
And they read to them because they were, of course, prohibited from learning to be literate or from being literate, period. And
yes.
The fact of the matter is that that kind of teaching of Christianity was a way of, I mean, there was all this Noah's curse of the darker sun and all this sort of stuff that was
the sons of Ham.
The sons of Ham, just lifted from the Bible as a justification.
And yet they couldn't get around the fact, one, there's, of course, the story of Exodus, and two, there is that fellow Jesus who was talking about the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God. Well, the idea of the brotherhood of man does not go so well with slavery. One of the unfortunate things is, and I've found a few testimonies, Solomon Northrup's 12 Years a Slave, revived by the movie, which was actually a bestseller in the 1830s when he wrote it. He talks about, since he was kidnapped into slavery he was a freedman in New York, he talks about what the slaves had to say during the compulsory sermons. But there are very few testimonies of this kind because there were so few slaves who could read. So an awful lot of our image of Christian slaves really doesn't derive from before the Civil War, but after the Civil War, when the Black Church was the one institution actually controlled by Black people themselves. So a lot of African Americans to this day are the most Christian community in the United States. But a lot of our ideas about how slaves felt about Christianity before the Civil War come from the sentimentalization of things like Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Uncle Tom's Cabin and all, yeah. Well, jump ahead, though. I mean, America's been such it's become kind of a supermarket for religions in many ways. I mean, we have all this Pew research that shows that about half of the people in the country have at least gone through one conversion or something attendant to.
Yeah, more than half, and a fair number of people have gone through more than one. By the way, politicians, one of the reasons it shows how much Americans don't disapprove of conversion. Former Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Tony Blair waited until he was no longer Prime Minister to convert from the Church of England to Roman Catholicism. But we have tons of people running for the presidency who have converted from all kinds of things. Look, George W. Bush, as is well known, and by the way, I should say that I define conversion in this book, for purposes of this book, as something that not only changes what you think about faith, but how you behave. George Bush's conversion
from alcoholism to
but also from the Episcopalianism of his ancestors to being an evangelical Christian, which probably would have horrified them as much as his giving up alcohol.
But Laura was a Methodist, and he was talking about Jesus even when asked who was the greatest philosopher. I thought it was a lot of influence of her.
But the influences of spouses are important. But the fact is George Bush, and sometimes, not always by any means, but sometimes conversion is linked with the desire to gain the strength from somewhere to give up a personal failing, like alcoholism. Or in my father's case, it was gambling. And I won't say, although my father was not a very devout Catholic or a particularly observant one, it did help him give up gambling. Just the routine, the ritual, the confession, it helped him.
So and religion helps lots of people.
That's also another secular fact, the desire to overcome some fault through some new faith.
Well, as one of the major atheists, intellectual atheists in our country right now, I mean, I was talking yesterday about the trinity of Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and Richard Dawkins, but maybe if there's a quartet you could get in there, and there should be women in there as well, I would argue. The fact of the matter is that, like, a friend of mine recently, his wife went through a stroke, and he said belief in God got him through. I mean, when people say that to you, because your atheism is pretty strong, what do you say?
I'm sure this is true for some people. When my partner died after having had Alzheimer's disease for some years in 2008. And people would ask me that question who knew about him. They would say, how can you get through this without believing in God? And here is what I said, and I say, I said, I couldn't get through this if I did believe in God. Because to me, a God who would make part of his plan depriving people as part of the process of dying of their memory, of the very thing that makes us human, of our memories, of everything we knew, of everything we lived before. If I believed that there was a God who allowed this to happen, I think I would go mad. And I think that people react differently. There are people to whom faith is a support. And there are people like me to whom that kind of faith would be far from being a support. It's the theodicy problem. I don't have it. I don't have to worry about why an all-loving God would do that to people because I don't believe he exists.
You are definitely free of theodicy problems, and we're talking, if you just joined us, with Susan Jacoby, the author of Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. Her other books include The Age of American Unreason and Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. She's going to be reading at Book Passage at the Ferry Building in San Francisco tonight at 6 p.m. And you can join us, and we do invite your calls and emails. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now. Again, 866-733-6786. Email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Susan Jacoby. She is here with us in studio. She's the author of a new book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion, and she'll be reading a book passage at the Ferry Building tonight at 6 o'clock. And we do welcome your involvement in the program, especially if you have a conversion story. You may want to join us, personal or otherwise. Getting a lot of those responses, and I'll get to some of them in a moment. But if you would like to add yours, by all means do. You can do that by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And I would also recommend, if you're calling in or if you would like to join the program, we're also talking about really the whole history of conversion, because she has, as I said, a really wide canvas and takes in conversions of all sorts, whether they're done for emotional reasons, addiction, spiritual faith, or by torture and fear of beheading. I mean, you know, you can find many reasons when you're looking at
history. That's a good one.
History. That's a fairly good one, yeah. We do welcome your involvement. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just a quick question, because you did an op-ed on this, and then we'll go to our callers and emailers. We're getting a lot of response, particularly the conversion experience question. Not surprisingly, but I was going to ask you about something you wrote about the there's a lot in your book about secularization, about how America's become more secularized, and yet at the same time very deeply religious and has a whole party tied to religion, the GOP. But there's really an important question that you raise. Why is it that agnostics, atheists, I mean, it used to be they were the village outcasts, you know, the village atheists. Why haven't they organized more politically, and why haven't they asserted themselves politically, afraid maybe even to check the box that that's what they are?
Well, I know more of the answers to this, or have more theories about it, than I did 8 years ago, because I get a lot of emails. One of them is that all of America, as we surely know, is not San Francisco or New York, where you can meet anybody of any kind of religion or non-religion walking down the street. After I wrote a column after Newtown saying that President Obama should not only have mentioned Jesus because there were non-Christians who were killed in that attack, he should have mentioned that secular people grieve just like religious people grieve too, not just faith as the answer to grieving. And one of the things I said in that is that more atheists need to come out so that people will recognize, as they have about gays in the last 15 years or so, that atheists aren't some kind of a demon out there. They're your neighbor. They might be your child. They might be your coworker. They're just ordinary people. Why, I have even had, when I lecture on college campuses, I've had students come up to me who said it was kind of uncool to call yourself an atheist. And women and girls say to me, I'm so happy you wear lipstick. They had an image of a female atheist as somebody who apparently didn't wear lipstick and dressed or this used to be the image of the feminist, too. But I think one reason, from the emails I get from Texas, a woman said, well, what would you do, Miss Jacoby? My husband and I say we're Unitarians because that's closest to what we believe. She lived in a suburb of Fort Worth.
That's a little like Republicans saying they're libertarians.
She said because our children would be bullied in school if we said we were an atheist. And this is a good question. In other words, there are parts of this country where what church do you go to is the first question you get asked, and not only in the South, in parts of the Midwest where I grew up as well. So that just actually, I think it's one reason a lot of people who say they're just unaffiliated or they're nothing in particular really are agnostics or atheists, but they don't want to label themselves as such. I've heard college students say this to me all the time. Well, I don't want to be labeled, but of course, I don't think of atheism as a label any more than Judaism or Catholicism has to be a label. It's part of what you think and who you are. But one reason atheists haven't gotten together as a political force. There are more actual people who aren't affiliated with a religion than there are members of any religion except evangelicals who combine Protestant denominations. Atheists tend not to be joiners. I have found this to be true in my experience, that there's something temperamental about atheism, maybe in this country because it's still a pejorative to call yourself an atheist, that atheists tend to shy away from group activity. That may be one reason. But I do think in a lot of the country, there is also the feeling that you don't have a lot to gain by revealing yourself as an atheist, and you might have something to lose, as in the case of people who worry about kids.
Pragmatic, and also with children. Good points. Also, we ought to mention that Susan Jacoby is on record as saying she waits for the day. Maybe this is a bit of a pipe dream when a president of the United States, of course, we thought president of the United States would never be African-American. Martin Luther King even didn't believe that could happen. So maybe this could happen as well. Instead of ending his speech by saying, God bless America, it would end the speech by quoting Thomas Paine about reason and the importance of reason. I don't know that we'll see that day, but I know that it's very much a pipe dream in your mind. Let me bring in our callers and let me begin, Jim, with you. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, I'm an atheist, and my father is a pastor, so talking about conversion stories, that was an interesting one, but he's very supportive of that. I think he's more of a humanist than anything else, and sees Jesus as a philosopher, more so than the evangelical wing of the Christian party. But my brother and sister are also atheists, and it was really reading Hitchens, God Is Not Great, that really started getting me thinking about, wait just a second, I'm not sure I'm buying into all of this. And the idea of if there is a God, then who created God really stuck with me.
Jim, can I tell you just a quick funny story about Hitchens' book? Because I don't know if you're a longtime listener, you know we had Hitchens on many times. But Salman Rushdie, who was a friend of Hitchens, also someone who's been on the program many times, said when he saw the title, God Is Not Great, he said, you could have just edited and got rid of great.
That's fantastic. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I'm pleased that you called, and I think you got a whole family for your pastor having fathered.
Jim, what age were you when you read? He's gone.
Yeah. I was going to get to another call. Lots of people want to weigh in here. Don, go ahead. You're on the air, Don.
Yes, I was wondering in her conversation and talked about being an atheist, I didn't realize that, and a Jew, but she's been discriminating because the original Jews that came to America were Sephardic Jews that were from Spain. And in 2007, finally, Spain acknowledged that there were 5,000 surnames that throughout the Americas there were Jews, Sephardic Jews. Now, how can she not be discriminating, and she's not mentioning the fact that the original Jews that came to America were of Spanish descent? And as a matter of fact, I had a friend that was Jacobi from Monterrey, Mexico, as a matter of fact.
Well, he's right. I mean, historically, the first Jews were.
But I don't know what you're talking about discriminating. Of course, the first Jews who came to America were Sephardic Jews. What does that have to do with anything? There are Sephardic Jews, there are Ashkenazi Jews, and there are mixtures, as in my family, and we don't even know fully because of the expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492, we don't know fully where all of them went. Some of them, for example, wound up in Poland and eventually later came here from Poland and were just thought of as Polish Jews rather than Sephardim or Ashkenazim. But I'm not discriminating against – what am I discriminating against?
I'm not running
against
to your defense, but I didn't
Jews
hear anything discriminatory
Jews are
there,
Jews.
Don. I didn't hear anything either that was discriminatory. Maybe the BBC. There's some sensitivity. I know.
Perhaps discrimination is not a word he understands.
Well, let me thank him for the call. No, there's some sensitivity in the Sephardic community about Ashkenazi hegemony and all that sort of thing.
But I wasn't talking about Ashkenazi Jews.
Let me get another caller on here. And that's Stefan from San Jose. Stefan, you're on.
Hello, Michael.
Hi.
I'd like to thank your guest's comments about how atheists tend to be nonconformers. I think that's very true. And I'd just like to say that for a number of years, I was actually, I'd probably label myself as an atheist. But after thinking about it some, I realized that to call yourself an atheist, and this all depends on how you define atheism, is almost of the same class or category as being a devout Christian or Catholic. If by that I mean that if you have absolute certainty that there is no mysticism to the universe or maybe God is the word you want to say, well, that's just as extreme a statement as saying that there absolutely is.
And no.
Atheists can be ideologically rigid.
Of course, atheists can be ideological and rigid, but I really want to answer this question. Atheism is not a religion. A religion says, I know. I would never say, I know there is no God, because you cannot prove a negative. What I say as an atheist is I believe on the basis of the evidence that I see that there is not a God.
I know atheists absolutely there is no God. I mean,
yeah,
with absoluteness.
But the fact is there are those kinds of atheists, and there are atheists like me. And because I do believe in science, and one of the premises of science, and by the way, science is not a religion either, which people incorrectly say, because science always has to be open to being proved wrong. I assure you, I don't say I know there is no life after death. I say I don't believe it on the basis of what I see. But if I come home from San Francisco tomorrow night and five of the beloved people I have lost during the last 10 years to death turn up at my door and say, how about making us that spaghetti carbonara we like so much, Susan? I assure you that I will change my views about this. But that isn't as ridiculous as it sounds, because in science all the time, we see that things that were thought to be true are modified by new evidence. I say, on the basis of the evidence I have and what I believe about what would be the horror if there were a God who allowed such things to happen, I think that there is no God, and I order my life in that way. But that there are atheists who are as intolerant as certain kinds of religious people, not all kinds of religious people. There are lots of religious people who aren't certain either. But this is, by the way, I never participate in debates about the existence of God for precisely this reason. It's Christopher and I, that's one of the disagreements we had. There are atheists who have absolute certainty who could claim it. I am not one of them, and atheism is not a religion.
Well, you sound, I mean, we've both written about Robert Ingersoll, the great agnostic. You sound almost more agnostic in some ways because there are atheists, as I say. Talk to somebody like Richard Dawkins. He's pretty sure there's no God. I mean, sure to the point beyond belief almost.
I'm pretty sure there's no God too, but it doesn't make me an agnostic. Sort of says, I don't know. Sort of says the evidence is kind of equal. I think the evidence is overwhelming.
There's a whole continuum for agnosticism.
Yeah,
some agnostics say there may be a little evidence, or I'm just uncertain because
what
of
Robert
this.
What Robert Ingersoll said was there is no difference between atheism and agnosticism, and I think he was right. He said Robert Ingersoll said, I don't know there is no God. I would never claim this. I just think on the basis of what I see and think and learn that there is not.
Do you know the great line? I think it was Mort Sahl's about agnosticism, that a family of agnostics moved in a neighborhood and someone burned a question mark on their lawn. I'm going to go to some of your emails here. Lori writes, I was raised in the liberal Bay Area, and my parents didn't want to decide my religion for me and my sister by baptizing us. This left me feeling like I was wandering around for religion and identity. And when I met my husband, who was Jewish, not raising children Jewish was a deal breaker. It was fine with me because I figured it was better to give them the identity and structure that they could eventually react against if they wanted. I ended up converting to much later. Some more of your narratives and comments.
Very common story.
Here's Marty, who says, I left the church when I saw the suffering of my mother and grandmothers as a result of having no access to birth control. My grandmother was widowed with 9 children, 3 grandchildren in 1921, before any social net whatsoever. My mother had 8 kids of her own, 6 after me. And Ellie writes, Torquemada was a converted Jew. He began the Spanish Inquisition. He came from a prominent Jewish family, the Mendozas. Also, Jews became newly respected after Israel's 7-day war, which showed the world the Jews were courageous. For hundreds of years, the Jews were portrayed as cowardly. Just kind of random comments, but here's another one from Gerald. I heard from my parents, so it must be true, that people who convert out of conviction are often more intense, if not fanatical, than those born of a faith. Does the evidence support this? And how do other sorts of converts behave? I've heard Spanish and Portuguese conversos were very careful to keep some ham on hand to publicly demonstrate their faith. It's a good question. I think they do often become more fanatical when they convert. I mean, look at some of these people who've converted to Islam.
Actually, it depends on the kind of conversion you're talking about. That they always used to say that in Catholic school, that converts are more Catholic than the Pope. But I think that's true. We don't have a lot of evidence about this because, first of all, the overwhelming majority of people who've written about their conversions were deeply spiritual converts. Ordinary people who convert, for example, the reason this woman for whom if she married a Jewish man, not raising their children Jewish would be a deal breaker. They don't usually write a lot about their experiences. We don't know much about ordinary conversions as we do about the great spiritual conversions like Augustine's. But I don't think that there is a lot of evidence necessarily that it depends on the kind of conversion. It may be true of some converts, but not of others. And I'd like to emphasize, I think one of the things, and this comes into our politics too, whether you're talking about Catholics or Jews or Christians or atheists, the generalizing, especially in America, about what converts are like or what atheists are like. Just take Catholics, for example. I went back a few years ago to my 50th eighth grade reunion of St. Thomas Aquinas School. All I can say is the nuns didn't do a very good job if our class was any. There were atheists like me. There were people who called themselves agnostics. There were people who had married into other faiths and converted. There were very few people who in any way practiced the Catholicism of our youth. There were observant Catholics, but they didn't have the views of pre-Vatican II church. So when I hear somebody saying Catholics this, Catholics that, it is like saying atheists this or atheist that, especially in the United States, people who profess religion come in so many varieties. And I think partly it's a result conversion exists in so many families. I hardly meet anybody who doesn't have a conversion story for me now.
Well, we're getting a lot of conversion stories. I want to go to our callers, but let me just read a few comments. Rob writes, here's a story from Rob who says, my crisis of religion started when I was 8 when I lost my beloved sister to a car accident. My pastor told me that God wanted her with him. I eventually went through Luther's catechism and with that pastor, but many teachings didn't make sense to me. In college, I took some classes on religions, eventually converted to Zen Buddhism. Now I'm a non-theist humanist Buddhist studying with a nice Zen teacher in Grayton. Thanks for asking. Ron writes, in 2014, I was ready to convert from unwavering lifelong atheism to a religion, any religion with a God that would save my wife's life, but none came forward. So I'm still an atheist, or to be more precise, I'm a person who does not believe the word God actually has a meaning. Here's Ben who says, just because someone is not religiously affiliated does not mean they don't believe in a higher power. Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go next to you. Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm just interested in how the difference between spirituality and religion is understood by the speaker here. It seems to me that atheism is being defined in terms of very specific traditional views of what God is or is not, and those views are put forth by organized religion. And just on a personal level, I believe that there's a whole lot more to the spirit than what is contained in any one particular religion. So if atheism is defined by a specific religion and you don't ascribe to any particular religion, where does that leave the person who's spiritual?
Ah, this is a great question. First of all, spirituality, it's not a word I use because to me it's just another word for the mind. And the mind and our neurological system, whatever you want to call it, what theologians and religions call the soul, there is an idea that atheism is defined as something that's against a traditional idea of God. And that therefore, and if you do that, of course, it doesn't leave room for we all have what might be called transcendent experiences, whether it's listening to music or seeing your child grow up, or very rarely, but once in a while you write a page and it makes you feel that it's the best you can do. All these things come, I would just say, from our mind. They are part of the best things that human beings can do. They are available, obviously, to everybody, whether they're an atheist or whether they profess a particular religion. But they are not supernatural. The difference between an atheist and a religious person, and it's why I don't think spirituality is any different from the experience of enjoying any of these great things that human beings are capable of, is we have a dimension that is beyond what we're usually able to do. But it's not supernatural. It's just the highest natural achievement that man can experience.
It's transcendent, perhaps, or something along transcendence.
I don't even like words like transcendent. It's something that makes you feel more. It's what you feel in the presence of genius. If, you know, when I hear the Goldberg variations, I think, you know, how can this genius have done this? I feel myself not taken into a supernatural world, but at the outer edges of what human beings can do. And that can be in science. Everybody talks. Yeah, atheists appreciate sunsets.
Here's Eric, who comments, "I love the conversation today. I feel as if the passionate defense of religious tolerance as a political idea is overused in defense of pushy religious ideas within institutions. I recently had a conversation with a friend who was court-ordered into Alcoholics Anonymous program, in which he was ridiculed for his atheism and resistance to the reference of a higher power and personal idea of God. He suggested that the word God could be replaced with discipline, strength of character, or personal responsibility. He was asked to leave. Seems to me religious tolerance is very one-sided." And here's Nick, who opens up a kind of bag of worms with, let me read this. He says, "I was hoping to get your guest take on this. I was raised in what I recall being named the United Church of Christ, and during one church camp field trip, we went to see the movie Amistad, and I was told that the abolitionists depicted in the movie were the forefathers of my church. Today, though, I am mostly agnostic and are atheist. I still enjoy going to the church services from time to time. One thing that I really like about the United Church of Christ is they're open and affirming. That means they're open to gays, lesbians, blacks, whites, everybody. What I'm saying is, I think about this sometimes. African Americans were brought to this country as slaves, told to adopt our religion. Then religious Christian abolitionists helped freed them, and now the descendants of those Christian abolitionists look a lot like me. That is, college educated, largely atheist, and accepting of the LGBTQ community, who are often spurned by those of faith. I don't know what to do with that, but it kind of sucks." You are a little tougher on the abolitionists and the link to their religious beliefs.
There were many religious abolitionists, but it's quite forgotten that there were also many, many, many Christian denominations in the North before the war that were not abolitionists, because they were far more concerned about maintaining their relationships with the southern branches of their church than they were with abolitionism. In other words, there was a split within Christianity itself, and it wasn't a North-South split. It was a split within Christian denominations about whether slavery was right or wrong. There are plenty of Christians. One of the things that's it's now scholars have been bringing it out for at least 25 years. But, for example, outside the South, the biggest slave-holding state before the Civil War, the most slaves were held in the state of New York. Good Christian people. So that, in other words, Christianity, we don't even talk about atheism here. There were free thinkers, and free thinkers were almost always abolitionists too, but they've been counted out because the image of religion as being the deliverer of slavery, though Abraham Lincoln, the president of the United States, was roundly criticized when he was in Springfield and he started running for the presidency because he refused to join a church. In other words, religion was as divided as everybody else in this country was.
And still is.
Was. And still is, yes, absolutely.
Let me go to more of our callers. Jim, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Welcome.
No problem. Your guest asked, when did I read God Is Not Great? I read it when I was 23, And I also wanted to share quickly, when I was an elementary school teacher, my class and I protested the Pledge of Allegiance because our school insisted on keeping under God. So we turned around and sat down in protest, which was interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And thank you for the call. Let me go to another caller, and that's a caller up in Sacramento. Russ, you're on.
Hey, great. Thanks for calling. Thanks for having the show. Quick question. Why are polytheists and maybe pantheists, multi-theists, pagans, in other words, so hated throughout history? Why are there no official pagan churches? Rome turned Catholic or Christian in, what, the 3rd century, and so all the pagans, I guess, had to convert, kind of like the Jews in Spain. But why is pagan used as a pejorative? And it's almost worse than calling someone an atheist. And I'll say,
oh, there are some people who embrace the name of pagan,
and there are people who call themselves pagans, and in America today, who understand it in the way that classical paganism was understood as not being something bad. The pagans in the Roman Empire, as the Western Empire became more and more Christian in the 4th century, were not, again, nothing happened to them in the way that it happened to, let's say, Jews and Muslims, by the way, eventually in Spain, on the Iberian Peninsula. But it became, as the Catholic Church became the position of power, and again, intermarriage. Augustine was the child of an intermarriage. His mother made it her mission to see that her husband and her son would eventually convert to Christianity. But this isn't the kind of forcing you get in Inquisition. It's when the tide changes, people tend to just go along with, you know, whatever is easiest. But I don't think that pagan is as much of a pejorative in America today as atheist, although I also don't think people know what pagans are. Pagans had to fight for the right soldiers to have a pentagram on their stones at Arlington, and they won in court.
Fascinating book. Susan Jacoby, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Your callers are great.
Susan Jacoby's book is Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion, and she'll be reading at Book Passage at the Ferry Building tonight at 6 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., and we welcome your responses to programs or suggestions about programs. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace, and our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.